The Extra Ball.
Hello and welcome to the show, episode 68 of The Extra Ball. Thank you for subscribing. I'm Dan Moylan and I'm joined remotely by Michael Normanson.
Hello.
And also by Moscow White, aka Daniel Chapman.
Hello.
We're giving a little pause to the Soccer Supreme on Mug this week just because we've got an awful lot to get through, but we still really want your questions. Send us a WhatsApp voice memo either through going to 07899 555 459 or head to thesquareball.net/WhatsApp and that will fill in that number for you inside the app. We want a voice memo, not a voicemail, not a phone call, a voice memo where you hit the little microphone button and hold it whilst you record yourself. I'll make you sound sparkling as well when we come to edit it, so don't worry about what you sound like, because that's the best way to get your hands on the Soccer Supreme on Mug, which will return next time. Up first then, an introduction to the quiz, aka Jamie McMastermind, Quizzy Brown, Catchphraser Richardson, Funhausen, etc. Moscow this time then.
Yeah, I'm all ready. I've got another round of questions all set to go. Are you excited for it, Michael?
I've got some questions for you first, both of you.
But you didn't win. You didn't...
These are just true or false questions, really simple. True or false, Linfield have played in this season's Champions League. True or false?
I've no idea.
Lin who?
Linfield, the Northern Irish team.
Who
they're
is
from
she?
Belfast. They're from Belfast.
Miss Field.
Have they been in the Champions League this year?
David Healy's Linfield.
Have they been in the Champions League? It's a simple question this year.
I've no idea.
No, they have not. Have 1860 Munich ever been in the Champions League?
Yeah, loads of times.
No, they have not. We have not played them in the Champions League. I was robbed. So basically, it's my quiz this week, Moscow, because you said 1860 Munich and you were bang wrong, which is Dan's fault. So I'm not going to go at you. Dan's the one that's got this wrong. Champions League qualifiers are not the same as the Champions League. If you look at the Wikipedia page for Champions League club performance comparison, where it has a massive table of every team to ever participate in it right from the start of the competition, if you go down to the Germany section, 1860 Munich, not there.
Well, let me just read these words to you, see what this sounds like to your ears then, okay? Third qualifying round, Champions League. What words jump out to you there? What are the words that really, really... I mean, what is it to you, Moscow? What words do you hear?
I mean, Michael has a point because you are a fucking idiot.
And it is right. You're qualifying for the Champions League. The obvious clue being you are not in the Champions League at that stage.
But the problem... and we addressed this last week, was that Dan had a list of clubs and 1860 Munich were on that list, therefore were admissible.
What if he'd had Port Vale on that list? Would that have been an acceptable answer?
I mean, Port Vale should have been closed down 100 years ago, but yes, it would. We would have had to accept that and just revel in Dan's stupidity going forward. I mean, if we're this worried about Lynn, you failed to mention Lynn Oslo, the other great lady of the European Cup, I believe. So don't be coming at me with pretending you've got knowledge.
Dan's fault.
You would have
it's
lost.
Dan's fault. It's not your fault, Moscow. No, because okay. You said 1860 Munich when the competition, we were still in the thick of the competition.
That's because I know how stupid Dan is and he would have them on the list.
So basically, Dan, I'll tell you what, Dan, it's Moscow's doing the quiz this week. I don't think we can do that. But what you can do is you can do the quiz equivalent of letting me walk the ball in. You should step aside as an apology for your pathetic quiz the week before. And I'm not Dean Smith. I'd do the right thing if I'd made this mess up.
I just want to tell you, I'm on the UEFA.com website on a sub-page called UEFA Champions League Fixtures and Results. And weirdly, they're showing the results from the qualifying rounds because it's part of the same competition. It's not a ghost competition, is it, where you are in this magical mystery tournament that doesn't really exist. It's just this tournament that exists in the ether, and then suddenly you arrive in the Champions League. It's very clearly a qualifying round for that tournament, and I'm looking at it right now on the UEFA website. So you're wrong. You're a fucking idiot.
Not having it.
You will also see there probably results for the European Championship qualifiers, but you would hardly say that, for example, Liechtenstein have a proud record at European Championships.
And I mean, looking at this as well, like the preliminary rounds, which I presume you're counting, it has champions from people like Luxembourg in there, who are F91 Dudelange. Are they a Champions League team? I imagine if you go to there, I imagine they've got money coming out of their ears because of their Champions League qualification, except they've never been in it because they always lose in the qualifying rounds.
They've graced the tournament every time they've been near it.
Ridiculous.
The thing is, if I said to you, there are 16 teams that Leeds have faced in the European Cup and the Champions League. Would you think that we hadn't played that game? Would you think of them or not? Because what I would say is...
I thought of them and I didn't say them because it wasn't the Champions League.
But I did say them because he said 16 teams and we've only played 15. So I knew he'd included them because he's an absolute dolt.
And I consider Moscow to be a man of at least moderate intelligence, and he got it. So I think it's an absolutely fair inclusion.
If he got it by knowing you're stupid, is that still acceptable?
It's all part of the game. You've got to. It's like you've got taking into account that the referee gives a lot of cards, and so you're not going to tackle as hard in that match. But the referee isn't on the other team, but is part of the competition. Dan's stupidity. It's kind of like knowing that Keith Stroud is...
Dan Moylan fucks pigs. That's what I'm going to say.
Took the words right out of somebody's mouth, not mine, for legal reasons, obviously.
Amazing, Moscow, that you are trying to talk down your own victory because you're a fucking idiot.
No, I'm talking it up.
This is not fucking pigs.
Unfortunately, you're wrong, and I stand by my result.
I stand by my victory, but I still think you're thick.
Well, we've finally arrived, ready for the shuddering climax of the 2009-10 season. Before we get to the barnstorming Bristol Rovers game, a quick reset on where we are. Second in the table with two games to go. We need to travel to Charlton. And another day of drama. And I think it's probably forgotten in the aftermath of Bristol that we could have gone up on this day.
Yeah, it was unexpected that it was expected on this day that Millwall would win and it wouldn't necessarily be much to play for us. We'd have to win to maintain our position, but... In the end, the Tranmere players of Leeds heritage, Andy Robinson, who I believe was on loan from us, and was it Ian Thomas Moore by this point, or just Ian Moore? I can't remember.
Ronnie's lad. Just call him Ronnie's lad.
Ronnie's lad had Tranmere 2 up at Millwall. So by the time we were kind of into the final stages of our game, we just knew that we needed to score and we were up. And that would have been a simple way to do it, wouldn't it?
And Simon Grayson went about it in the simplest way he knew possible. All the strikers go on the pitch, and if you do that, you'll score loads of goals.
Yeah, I've no idea what formation it was by the end, but we've got Becchio, Beckford, Grella, and Gradle, and Sanchez Watt all on.
And Richard Naylor, don't forget, was a striker when he began at Ipswich and had just scored those two at Yeovil, so was in goal-scoring form.
And it continued with a delightful 88th minute goal into his own net.
I remember this game was beamed back to Elland Road and watching it in the East Stand. And I think this was I know it was the days of Bates, but from memory, the weather, it was a really sunny day and the screen, I think they were just using the scoreboard. They hadn't actually put a screen in the middle of the pitch like they had at some. There was some problem like that. And basically it was unwatchable. You couldn't see what was happening. So we made for the concourse, and it was actually better to stand underneath the stand on the concourse, watching it on the little tellies above the bars. And the atmosphere down there was weird, because I think the players have kind of said the same thing about the game. It was such a free hit, and they knew they'd have another game, and there was kind of nothing changed if we didn't win this match. It was just like an extra bonus opportunity to give it a really good goal that... Yeah, it was disappointing when Richard Naylor scored, unexpectedly disappointing, but not completely crushing.
It's a nice little microcosm of the Bates era, is that paying money for unwatchable football at Elland Road. But I mean, I was at Charlton for this, and I've got to say, I don't remember a great deal of it because I think I drank very heavily to calm my nerves before, and I can't remember a single thing that happened in this game. I watched the goal back and just thought, yeah, never seen that before in my life. Never mind. I think it was one of those that I didn't particularly focus on when I got home either, because you know what it's like when you... I don't know what you're like, but if Leeds have lost, I tend not to watch the Football League show. I just pretend it's not happened for another week.
What was your day out at Charlton like then, Michael?
I don't remember.
I mean, literally nothing.
I have no idea. It was a London trip, so it'll have been early train, probably go to the Rocket near Euston. Then, I don't know. I think Charlton's one of those grounds that's... It's miles out, isn't it? It's one of those where you're not actually anywhere near the ground when you sort of arrive in London and think, right, we're here now. And then you've got another 50 minutes to sit on a train. But I can't honestly remember. I can vaguely remember leaving the ground and having all confirmation that it was sort of fine because Millwall had lost and everyone was all right about it because we only had Bristol next and they had nothing to play for and we were at home and it was like, you know what? In many ways, maybe it's nicer to go up at home, because if we'd have gone up here, there'd have only been a couple of thousand Leeds fans. It wouldn't have been... I was trying to basically convince myself it was fine, is all I can really remember.
Wasn't fine, though, was it?
It was fine.
In the end, it was fine.
Just to look at the season as two halves, just going into the final game. From the first 23 games, we took 56 points. And from the second lot of 20, from the next 22 games, we'd taken 27 points. So 2.43 points per game to 1.23 points per game. It's an absolutely spectacular fuck-up with this season to have got to this point and not just already be promoted. Like, Norwich had showed us how to do it. Like, they're on 95 points at this stage, having lost the first game 7-0, I think, or something ridiculous. They just won every match, which is what we were doing for a time. But we thought, no, why not take it to the very last day, the very last half of the very last day? Let's see what happens then.
And there were, what, one, two, three, technically four teams still in the running. So if we'd have lost on that last day, we could have handed it to any one of Millwall, Swindon, all Charlton. So tremendous pressure going into it. Now, I mean, I have said before on podcasts that...
Don't rule out Huddersfield. Huddersfield will have still fancied it as well. I think if we lost, Millwall and Swindon drew, Charlton lost or drew, and Huddersfield won by about six, Huddersfield could have still gone up as well. So, you know, I'm sure they wouldn't have ruled themselves out.
They were as involved as they always are.
I mean, yeah, I missed this game. I was on my mate Stag Do over in Manchester, and I do regret it massively, having missed one of the few brilliant celebratory days, because I was just convinced, based on that first half of the season performance, that it would be done and dusted by now. Alas, I'd committed to going, so I was in Manchester when all this was unfolding, sort of checking my phone frantically. What was it like? Because I'd like to experience it by proxy if I could. What was the atmosphere like before the game? Was there expectancy there or nerves? What was the sort of feeling around the ground?
I remember it being tense, but I think there was a feeling we were going to do it and it would be all right. I don't know, these days I feel like I'm maybe a bit more pessimistic than I was then. But I felt like this season, it had been our season in a lot of ways. And even though we'd knackered it up at one point, it had come back round. We only had to beat Bristol on the last day. We under Grayson, we just won these games all the time, generally speaking, against mid-table opposition at home. They had nothing to play for. I thought we'd be all right. And I don't think it was... And I think mainly it was people there for a party rather than people there being really tense and nervous.
You can hear watching it back what was happening in the crowd can be sort of summed up by the fact that the East Stand throughout the entire 90 minutes of the game is stood up, and you don't normally get that. And nobody was telling them to sit down either as well. And the first 10 minutes or so, or the first few minutes, there's a big cheer when Leeds get the first tackle, and then Bristol misplace a pass, and there's a big ah, and then they've got the ball for a minute and there's boos, and Leeds win it back and there's cheers. That's how up for it everyone was. And I think the feeling of the day was that you were arriving to kind of cheer the team over the line. I honestly can't remember if I expected us to do it or not, but the expectation was we were there to do this with them, that it had come down to this last game, and part of the event was the crowd being on the side of the team. Obviously, after about a quarter of an hour, I think there's a bit where the ball goes out of play, the players don't quite take advantage of an attack, and instead of the raucous Elland Road support, you hear, "Oh, for fuck's sake, come on," and all the that dissatisfaction that immediately sets in when we have to actually watch Leeds United play was very quickly took over. You can't get through. You can maybe be confident for the first 5 minutes, and you can do that boo the opposition, cheer the Leeds passes, but because we weren't 4-0 up after 15, 20 minutes, it immediately became, oh shit, we're actually watching Leeds United play. Fuck.
We were decent in the early stages as well. I watching this game back, it's weird. Other than the main goals and everything and the sending off, the loads of it I'd completely forgotten about. Like 2 minutes in, it looks like Gradle's got a completely free header in the box, but I think it's just behind him and it kind of hits the back of his head. But look, if you kind of freeze frame it, you'd think he's just going to tap it in. And you see in the early stages as well, which again, I've not noticed how much of a thing Gradle and Daniel Jones was in that early stage. Is that a couple of minutes in, Gradle gets a big shove from him. Then a few minutes after that, Daniel Jones is already being booed. And then Gradle like absolutely charges in and puts a two-footer in on him over on the right wing. And I don't know, you can see at that stage that Gradle's pretty much lost his head already.
And you forget, we absolutely had two, if not three, really clear-cut chances before it all went mental. I mean, we should have been in front. There's no two ways about it. We're talking just marginal clearances. There was not that one that nearly went to Becchio where it just would have just needed a tap in. I think there's a cutback across the face of goal. I think it was Bygradle, actually, that should have gone in.
It feels a little bit like watching us in the game we just saw against Stoke. It's one of those where you think, we'll score eventually because we're all over them. And they're not very good, and it's just a matter of time until we break them down. We also had at the time to contend with stuff going on elsewhere as well, because you're always kind of checking scores elsewhere. And I think early stages, Huddersfield were up. It didn't really matter, to be honest, their game. But then Swindon had gone a goal up against Millwall as well. So that meant with us drawing, that was actually putting Swindon up. Then on 14 minutes, Steve Morrison equalises for Millwall, which actually helped us because that put us back in. But then you're thinking, oh, well, Millwall will go and score then. And I think their goal difference was better than Swindon's as well. So with all the various things that could go on, you had this kind of constantly shifting picture. And what you didn't need was a lunatic.
But lunatic is what we got. What do you think made him lose his head that day? Do you think he was just so fired up because there was so much at stake?
Daniel Jones had done a great job on him, in truth. He'd wound him up so much. It was going on right from the start, and it seemed Jones always seemed in control of it when you watch it back. Like, whenever there's a bit of pushing and shoving going on, it's him that's leading it. Gradle looks absolutely livid about the whole thing right from pretty much the first minute.
He didn't play the occasion wisely. I think a sending off like that, if it had been away at Stockport in February, not a big problem. But the circumstances around everything, I think he knew that getting a red card in that game had let everybody down, and that it was, you know, if Leeds didn't win the game, it was going to be Max Gradle's fault. As soon as the red card goes up, the importance of everything that was happening must have hit him. And then you add to that the injustice that he did not think there was any reason to send him off, and that Daniel Jones had been asking for it, had faked his dive, had basically engineered the whole thing so that now it was going to be Max Gradle's fault. And yeah, I think it was just upset. He was very upset.
There are two things to deal with here as well. Gradle's an absolute idiot, but Daniel Jones is a big fucking cheat as well. Make no bones about it, he makes a complete meal of what happens. Like, it's a very odd thing that happens. I've not seen anything like it on a football pitch before. They kind of come together, then Gradle sort of looks like he might stamp on him a bit, but then weirdly, Daniel Jones is then lying on the floor holding his face, and I'm sure nothing goes near his face. I don't know if you saw it any differently, Moscow. I don't think he goes anywhere near him. And then he sort of goes down while hugging him as well.
Gradle gets involved with him, and there is that sort of stamping motion, and I think Daniel Jones realises, if I make a big thing out of this, I can get him sent off. So he does, he kind of grabs him to pull him closer, and then kind of pushes him backwards as a means of throwing himself to the floor. And then the obvious next step is just put your hands to your face, because you can say, oh yeah, I was covering my eyes because my foot really hurt, or, you know, or the way that he'd kind of engineered this tangle of arms to happen, so he could kind of say, oh yeah, he's just caught me, he's done me, and it would be enough for the referee to buy it and send him off. And in the end, that's exactly what happened.
We have completely ignored the fact as well that just before this, Beckford has had the ball in the net, but it's given for offside. There doesn't seem to ever be an angle of it that shows conclusively, but, you know, it probably is. But to go from thinking we've scored to then, oh no, we've not scored, and we're down to 10 men. And not only that, he may never leave the pitch.
Like you, Michael, I've watched this and I can't quite fathom what's gone on. And in the commentary mentions the stamp, doesn't it? But it's not clear cut by any stretch of the imagination that's actually taken place. I mean, what at that point was the atmosphere like in the stadium? Because like you say, you've gone from this, it's only a matter of time, we've just had the ball in the net. And when that happens, you get that kind of rising sense of occasion that it's coming, it's going to happen anytime soon. And then suddenly your world collapses.
That about describes it. We fucked it, I think was certainly my initial thought when this happened. It was like, well, that's it then. Playoffs it is. Nice one.
Because a red card does absolutely change the complexion of any game, doesn't it? At that point, you're thinking, well, that's our chances of winning gone, but we need to win. So at that point, you're trying to compute how we're going to navigate this path through this.
Well, it wasn't only the red card. It was his refusal to leave. And what that meant was that instead of a player walking off the pitch, and then you do have that thing of, well, down to 10 players, how are we going to get through the rest of the game? Watching it, it was as chaotic as it looks on video. Now, you're trying to work out, I was in the East Upper, and you're trying to work out from there, why is Beckford now fighting Max Gradle? And bear in mind, you know, Beckford had been out of the team, and he's just come in and he's been given the captain's armband, which was kind of the big pre-match surprise that for his final game in a Leeds shirt, he was made captain. And, well, okay, well, let's look how that's turning out, because you couldn't really tell from the East End what Beckford was doing. Is he slapping him about? Is he in there pummeling him? Is he angry with Max Gradle and is trying to have a fight with him? And then you've got Mike Doyle goes over and starts trying to drag Gradle down by his shorts and ends up lying on his back. I'm sure Bradley Johnson was over there at one point as well, but didn't hang around. Then it's and then you realise, right, it's Beckford and Doyle are trying to take Max off the pitch, and he won't leave, and he's trying to get at the referee. And the thing you didn't need to happen then was for a Leeds player to punch the referee. And eventually, Andrew Hughes is over there telling him to get off the pitch, and you've got security people coming on. You've got the stewards, police are hanging around looking at this. And what sometimes doesn't get mentioned in all this, when he does finally walk off, you can hear it in the crowd. Everybody in Elland Road is chanting off, off, off at our own player, because nobody was having any... There was no sympathy for Max Gradle. There was no kind of, he's always been a bit mad, isn't he? It's that little idiot has ruined our attempt at promotion, because red card, you've got players fighting each other. We've got to play, it's quite early in the game. There's still more than an hour to go with only 10 players in the most important match. And it kind of made everything, all that togetherness, everything you heard in the first 5-10 minutes of, you know, cheering every Leeds touch and roars for every single tackle, has been replaced by us chanting off, off, off at one of our players, wondering what the next stage is going to be. Is, you know, Beckford and Doyle now going to have a scrap? Is, you know, Simon Grayson going to get Glyn Snodding in a headlock or something? It just felt like, what more can happen now?
And we do lose our heads around it as well. Like, not long after it, there's... I mean, the ref has kind of lost it as well, not probably surprisingly. I do feel a degree of sympathy for the referee through this game, actually. I remember at the time I absolutely hated him, but it must be bloody awful trying to control something like this when you've got this sort of intransigence of a player just going, I know you've sent me off, but here I am still. What are you going to do about it? Because you can't really move a flailing Max Gradle off a pitch, can you? You just have to hope someone else does it, or that eventually he'll change his mind and go. But like, not long afterwards, Daniel Jones, in fact, is down the left and he crosses one in, which Higgs is about to collect. Collins heads it away and Higgs is bollocking him. Then Doyle has it out on the touchline straight afterwards. The ref, again, I think, judges this wrong, or the linesman says it's gone out of play and it hasn't. It goes to Kilkenny, just like blasts it into the west stand. And it just has a general feel that everyone's going a bit mental about it. Doyle fouls Daniel Jones straight after it. It feels like there's probably going to be about another 3 red cards in this, or maybe everyone will just choose to walk off the pitch because they're sick of it.
I was just going to say, I don't think I noticed it at the time, but that Doyle foul on Daniel Jones does give a hint of the togetherness that did exist. Whatever Max Gradle had just done to annoy him and leave him on his back looking stupid as he was trying to drag him off the pitch, and however much Gradle had then let everybody down, he made a decision, right, who got Gradle sent off? You. I'm going to snap your legs the next chance I get.
And he actually doesn't. He misses him, but Jones still goes down as if he has, because he's a cheat. But, I mean, Doyle's quite funny in this game. He spends all game hurting people and pretending he can, then being absolutely astonished. There's one early on where he both pulls a player's shirt back so he can kick him, and it's a kind of a double whammy, and then he gets up and he's completely shocked that the referee has chosen to give a free kick against him, which is, it's nice. I think we can see in this game why people like Andy Hughes speak so highly of Mickey Doyle, because he's doing some horrible stuff in this game, which isn't particularly adding to our play, but you can imagine as an opposition player, it's not very pleasant.
I mean, we will get on to what happened to the Bristol Rovers players psychologically, but just zeroing in on Jones for a second, you get the feeling that he knew he was then going to be targeted, and he did crumble by and large in this game, so says the narrative anyway. And Simon Grayson at one point was telling him, wasn't he, towards the end of the game, you better get on this side of the stadium because they'll come for you, kind of thing. So there was some mind games going on, I think, and ultimately in the end when we did win it, it was almost a psychological victory as much as anything.
Simon Grayson says that his quote to Jones was, I think it was at half time as he went down the tunnel, and there was a lot. You could see players getting in each other's faces as they went off the tunnel. And he found him and he said, I think it's fucking good luck getting off this pitch if we don't win.
Absolutely love that. So what was that little run into halftime like then? Because it's 12 minutes between Gradle getting sent off, the halftime whistle going. Was it kind of the adrenaline of the post-red card chaos, trying to find our feet in it? What was it like?
It was just all a bit chaotic. And I think I just wanted it to get to halftime because you think, well, you can at least reorganise then. Everyone has a bit of time away from actually playing just to calm the fuck down a bit. Because it was just frantic after that. We were still in the game. I'd say watching it, you can't really tell that we've got 10 and they've got 11 because we're still in it, but it's all not really going to plan, and we've lost our shape completely and we're not playing the sort of football we should. It just seems to have got like broken out into a series of small arguments.
Interesting comments from Andy Hughes about the halftime break, because when chaos has broken out in the stadium, you sometimes do forget that there are professionals on the field and they've probably got a slightly better handle on things than we do in the stands when we're going through absolute living hell in this game. What was it that he said about it? It was calm and normal.
Yeah, he just said it was no different for Grayson. He sort of gave him a bit of a talk about shape and stuff, but Gradle was out of there. I think he'd been crying in the dressing room earlier, but I think he'd been taken out before the players got back in there. He said everyone was all right about everything, which is quite surprising considering.
I think from the oral history that we had in the summer special, speaking to some of the players and Simon Grayson and Glyn Snodden, it took a few minutes to get to that normal. I think you could see as everyone went down the tunnel, there was arguments breaking out. There's a moment where the referee actually kind of shoves Beckford to one side, and Beckford's like, what the hell is the referee now shoving me for? And the referee kind of goes back to him and says, no, I needed to go and break those guys up, so I had to shove you out of the way. And yeah, there's various reports on where exactly Max Gradle is found. The most sort of likely one, because they have the benches, apparently he was underneath the benches that they get changed on, sort of half hiding, half crying. And the first thing that happened was that there was a big hunt, right? Where the fuck is Max? We're going to tear him to pieces. And it took the management to kind of like get him out of the way, get him in another room, get everybody calmed down, sort this out. And then it's the plan for the second half, what Simon Grayson said that we're going to do, was essentially calm, normal, it's fine. We're going to beat them anyway. We just need to score a goal. We don't need Max to do that. Don't worry about him. He's gone. Here's how we'll play. Here's the organisation that we haven't had for the last 15 minutes since he was sent off. And then send them back on the pitch, calm and determined to do a job, all except Shane Lowry, who didn't appear to have been listening.
Just keep it tight for the first 5 or 10 minutes. Yeah, feel your way into the game again.
I find it really interesting that they harnessed the power of the crowd that day. And it was basically a full house, wasn't it? 38,000 and a bit. They harnessed the power of the crowd, yet were so calm in their own approach to it. It just shows you that difference between the pros and what we feel, what we do experience in the stands. What was it like in the stands then when they did take the lead just after halftime? Because that's doubling down on your, oh shit, we've totally leads it up feeling, surely.
I didn't see a way back at that point. I would be surprised if anyone did, to be honest. And I think around that same time as well, Charlton are a couple of goals up as well. So even they're ahead of us at the time. And you know that anyone scoring in Millwall against Swindon puts them up. So it just feels like we've got a huge amount of things against us at this stage. And I genuinely do. I had no hope, I don't think, at this point.
Down to 10 players. Fine. That's okay. We can deal with that. Going down to 10 players and then conceding a stupid goal to Bristol Rovers, of all people, you just started to feel, yeah, this is ruined. This is Leeds. And who's going to get a ticket for the playoff semi-final? Would you even have gone?
I'd have gone, and yeah, I wouldn't have enjoyed it, of course, but I'd have gone. I mean, and it's Daniel Jones as well. I mean, his original cross is that bad. You can hear the crowd go, way, because everyone's sort of baiting him at this point. And the reason everyone cheers is because it goes way out to the back post to Shane Lowry, who's at left back, who should just deal with it. And this is why I hated him. I think I was not set on Shane Lowry at any point. I never thought he was very good. In this game, absolutely nothing he does could even be described as adequate. He's putting it in the stands. He's missing it. At one point, he tries to kick it, completely misses the ball. And then on this, like Neil Collins not exactly the silkiest footballer. In fact, watching this game, one of the most basic footballers you've ever seen, to be honest. Like, he just gets it and boots it every time. But Neil Collins cannot believe Shane Lowry in this game. You can tell he's just thinking, I've come here on loan and I'm being forced to play against alongside you. What the fuck are you?
I thought it was really illuminating on the watch back that the club did with Ben Parker and Andrew Hughes and Jermaine Beckford watching this game.
They all hate him, very clearly.
Well, yeah, I mean, they praise everybody. You know, Neil Collins is a leader in Hughes's words, and they're even bigging up Lubomir Mikulic at one point. You know, good. He could have been so much better if he'd only had a bit more drive. But
lovely,
you know,
guy, though.
Lovely guy, quality footballer. They absolutely lash into Lowry over this goal. And then there's a very telling comment from Hughes where he just says, I thought he gave us nothing this season. And he's kind of like, what did you guys think? And I think Beckford and Parker's kind of diplomacy kicks in a little bit, and they just focus on the goal. But Hughes, straight out, not a good word to say about him, just, I thought he came in and didn't give us anything this season. And can't
I think
argue
it's telling
that
as well, when he refers to him as, he doesn't refer to him as Shane or Lowry or anything else. As everyone else, the people have got nicknames. It's Lubo and it's Doyler and it's his exact words. No way should he have that pullback. The left back, Lowry. Just very descriptive. The left back, Lowry. Then he goes, even you know, Ben. I mean, you're a left back. I played there. He's basically, even you, Ben, even with your crippled legs, you would have done something better than that, wouldn't you? Jesus Christ, Shane Lowry. I mean, it's Grayson's fault slightly for continually playing him. But thankfully, this was basically his last act in a Leeds shirt as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, he was substituted shortly afterwards, and I don't think anybody was sad to see him go.
And things improved immeasurably, instantly, almost.
And that's the beautiful thing about these shit or bust games, is that a substitution like Lowry off, Housen on, happened in the 54th minute. It is a very clear positive roll of the dice, because we needed to win. As we pointed out at the start, there's four or five teams vying for that second spot. A victory by any of them in the face of a draw or a defeat by us could have knocked us down. So we had to win. We had to roll the dice. And all credit to Grayson for doing so.
Housen's not on long before he scores, but even straight away, he's just involved in stuff and he looks like he's on to try and take the game by the scruff of the neck a bit. He actually wants the ball in a way that, I mean, Shane Lowry would do right to not want the ball, in truth. But he looks like he's going to make something happen. And then the finish itself is an absolute beauty. Like, you wouldn't ordinarily expect him to score from there. And particularly with the amount of pressure on it, it comes as like I remember it being a weird wave of release and optimism as the ball hits the net. It felt prior to that like it was inconceivable that we would be able to get out of this horrible corner we'd got ourselves in. But then when that goes in, it was a bit of a, oh, fuck, here we go. This is now an option again.
It was quite unexpected, but then you look at Housen and you think, who else in that team is going to score from 25 yards? There wasn't really anybody in the side who had that kind of shooting in them.
Given 600 shots on target, Bradley Johnson may have got one in.
Obviously, and he saved it for that absolutely brilliant one against Arsenal in the FA Cup. Snodgrass could do it, but he was on the bench. Neil Kilkenny ain't going to shoot. Doyler, if it's not a square ball, he's not interested. And Becchio and Beckford were penalty box players. So it was only when Housen comes on, you've suddenly got somebody who has got a shot from outside the box in them. And when you talk about pressure, the goals that Housen's scored for Leeds, remember the Carlisle away playoff semi-final? What a moment that was that Housen gave us up there. And then he comes to this one when we absolutely needed it, and he did it again. Two occasions that, I don't know why, maybe it's the time, maybe it's because he hadn't found himself as a good player. He was always derided for going missing in games at this time, and maybe because he ended up at Norwich and Borough and places, but there were the sort of goals that you'd put alongside Strachan in 1990 against Leicester for, we need a goal from somewhere, who is going to be the leader to just whack one in. And it's not like the Beckford goal that comes up later where it's kind of, it happens for him and it's set up and he has to finish it. It's Johnny Housen taking on a brave shot from outside the box and executing it perfectly.
Credit to Becchio as well, because it's a very nice, it's a perfect lay back to him. It's just, there's no pace on it whatsoever. He's just almost teeing it up for, he's almost putting a set piece on for him. He's just trickles it towards him and they're like, go on, you just whip that into the corner. That'll do nicely.
So what was that period like between Housen scoring and the winner going in? I'm interested just to, can you remember what Elm Road was like in that sort of, it was only a short window.
Bizarrely, in that window, we were, even the draw was enough to put us up because Charlton were winning still, but we had better goal difference than them, and Millwall and Swindon were still 1-1. So weirdly, we were actually going up with a draw at that point. I don't think it ever calmed down between the goals. It was one of those goal celebrations that goes on for a good couple of minutes and then straight into a few songs. And before you knew it, it happened again. And it was one of those, a bit like, I guess, the Blackburn game last season where we scored the two in injury time. When the goals come that close together, it's more or less just a continual celebration and falling over seats. And I mean, these were proper celebrations in this game as well. Even for the Housen equaliser, which could have meant nothing, people went absolutely mental.
That's the moment in particular that I'm regretful that I missed. This one hitting the net, the second goal hitting the net, and knowing you've done what you need to do. Obviously, there's still quite a lot of game to play yet, and we'll get on to what happened psychologically to Bristol in a second in the wake of this. But in that moment, did you know?
I wouldn't have said I knew, because we still can always mess it up, but it was a goal that made me want to sort of cry and faint at the same time. It was a proper thing where the blood felt sort of drains from you, and it takes you a while afterwards to regain yourself, because I don't think you breathe properly when you're jumping around celebrating either. I remember from I think it must have been like about 30 seconds after the balls hit the net, I ended up like head to head with my friend Callum, and we had a weird quiet moment of just pressing our heads against each other, being like, let's just calm down now. We might do this. Maybe this is where it ends. Maybe this is the end of League One. But I don't think anyone would have been necessarily completely confident at that stage.
The East Stand. So I was in the upper tier of the East Stand. The thing to know about the East Stand is it's great. You know, it's a beautiful thing. And it was built in 1993 cheaply, incredibly cheaply. People still look at the price that Leeds United paid to have that thing built. And it is astonishing how cheaply it was done. It was done, Peter Gilman, who was on the board, was kind of the third of the Leslie Silver, Bill Fotherby combination. He was the third one. And he had a building company, and it was his building company built it and came in incredibly cheap, really cheap. And it was shaking. And I did not like that because I knew how cheap it was. And something that big should not shake that much. And if you've ever been in the upper tier of the East Stand, it is steep, and it is quite frightening up there. I wasn't a long way back. I've been right on the back row before, like watching a game of Sabutio. But that's the main thing I remember, is that the stand was shaking, and it shouldn't be shaking. And everything had flipped with those two goals. It was interesting watching the watch back, the players, and I think everybody who was involved in this game. You don't remember how close together the two goals were, and you also don't remember how early they were in the game, how long there was still to play. It's like this explosion of euphoria with those two goals. And the moment I always zero in on the footage of it now is Becchio grabbing Jermaine Beckford from behind and dragging him to the floor, and he's lying on top of him, and Beckford's lying face down with Becchio on his back, so he doesn't know who's dragged him. And because there's people on the pitch, you know, he can't see who it is. That's just, is it a fan? Is it some huge Leeds fan? Is it a security guy? And he kind of like forces himself rolling over in this grip. And then he sees Becchio's face, and the two of them embrace as if they've not seen each other for 20 years and have been reunited. And, you know, they're long lost brothers. And it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen happen in football. And I think that was probably happening all over the stadium. There was not anywhere that was not carnage of that kind.
I think the other bit of the goal that sums it up is the Bradley Johnson's jumping. Because it's a split second. Johnson, he's actually quite good in this game, is Johnson. I forget, watching it back, how crucial he was to the way that team played, with the big diagonal balls to him that he'd try and head on and stuff. But the ball's come out to him. Just to go through the goal, the keeper's thrown it. Beckford's got his head on it. Johnson picks it up. I think he's pretty sure he tries to shoot from a bit of a strange angle at the left-hand side of the goal. But in the time between the defender getting a foot to it and it dropping to Beckford, Johnson is just jumping up and down on the spot in what is a completely unprofessional thing to do. Like, you know, he could be using that time to adjust himself, get himself in a better position, thinking if this keeper saves this, where will it come to? But instead, like all of us, he's just jumping up and down, presumably going, he's going to score, he's going to score, he's going to score. And he does.
There was that moment of expectation just before Beckford scored, because it was quite similar to the goal he scored against Norwich when their keeper threw the ball out in stoppage time and Beckford got it and scored a late winner. You knew he'd done this kind of thing before. And also, you'd seen him score. How many goals had he scored at this point? 50, 60. I mean, maybe it's the good thing about the team at the time is that if it had fallen to Becchio, you'd probably still think that ball is going in the net, which is a really powerful thing to have at the top of your team. Bradley Johnson knew that Jermaine Beckford is not going to not score that. And his celebration, one of the things I liked in the summer special, the oral history, was Mickey Doyle saying that he just ran across the pitch to Neil Kilkenny, was the person nearest to him. And Doyle said that he was crying. Doyle was crying. And there's still, you know, there's 25 minutes of this game to play. And our tough tackling midfielder has got tears in his eyes. That was the thing about it. Once we had the lead and we'd switched it around from being from only having 10 players and being a goal down, we weren't losing from that moment. We'd won that game.
And that's what I was referencing earlier. At that point, that's when the switch went. And you forget, at the same moment that that goal went in, Millwall have gone in front, so we absolutely need to win. It feels to me, looking from the outside anyway, that at that moment, it was in the bag and there was no way we were going to let Bristol Rovers back into this. Was that reflected in the ground? Because the way I look at it now is that the crowd saw that victory through. They just drove the team on so much.
It's very strange watching it back. You would have no real, until maybe the last sort of 10 minutes when we do look, I'd say, obviously tired. Bristol are not in this game particularly, and they don't seem overly bothered about scoring a goal, is the way I would judge it. Like, because we have got so much adrenaline pumping through the side, I think, that we do seem to just be running faster than them. It's a bit like watching us the other night against Stoke. It's that sort of a half where we just seem to be first to everything and just have so much more desire than the opposition to win this game. And from 2-1, you get the impression they kind of want to get off the pitch and get home and get on holiday.
Why would you equalise? Why? Why would you even do it? I mean, Daniel Jones has already been, you know, told that he will die if we don't win. So why would you bring that upon yourselves? There was enough appetite in Bristol for them to want to go ahead and to start the game wanting to win. But once it had got to that stage and those circumstances, why? Why would you even bother? The thing about this this last 20 minutes, though, and it came up in the interviews for the oral history as well. It was both Rob Conlon and me who did them and spoke to all these people, found nobody can remember anything about those last 20 minutes. That there was so long left to play, it's kind of been forgotten. And my memory of it all is Howson equalises, Beckford scores, and then I'm on the pitch chasing Robert Snodgrass. And there's nothing else. It's just, there's that feeling of the stand shaking and noise, but I don't remember it lasting for 20 minutes. It just feels like it was just one moment that was just a seamless victory. The only bits that kind of register is injury time and stoppage time, when you're kind of thinking nerves set in under any circumstances when there was so much at stake. But it's that kind of like, it was like waiting for Christmas. You're waiting for the final whistle because you're so excited for that to come. Bristol, they may as well have just walked off the pitch and left us to it for 20 minutes.
There were a few little bits of danger. There's like one where Higgs has to throw himself at the feet of an attacker, and I think there's another bit where the ball falls to someone in kind of the same position as Luton scored from this season, where he tries to curl it into the top corner and completely messes it up. So there are still moments of that, but then we have our own as well, when you get Bromby heading it back across goal and it hits the inside of the post and Becchio's about an inch from it. In a lot of ways, I kind of wish, if I could change one thing about that game, I might want Becchio to have a goal in it. If Becchio can just get his head on this and make it 3-1, it'd have been a nice thing for him to have, I think, as one of those achievements on his Leeds career, because he was part of this promotion winning team, but he didn't score any of the big goals in it. So I'd have liked that for him on reflection.
And of course, Beckford got to say his farewell in amongst all the chaos. in injury time, a nice moment for him to say goodbye to Ellen Road.
When you watch back the video of this, you get Beckford comes off and Grayson gives him a, not like a standard, you've had a good game kind of hug, but that kind of wedding day, embracing a son, sort of a hug or something like that. Or, you know, we've just won the lottery, let's have a big hug. And they both look like they were, well, you can, I think it's Grayson's face you can see on it, but he looks like he wants to cry. I suspect Beckford's the same on the other side, and watching it back, I feel the same as well. It's one of those things of, that's the moment that where they're basically acknowledging we've done this, even though there's a few minutes to play. They know at that point that there's nothing more to play in this game. Possibly the clue is that it cuts to Grayson a second later, and you can see Daniel Jones basically stood next to him, who should have been playing on the opposite side of the pitch, but is instead stood by the tunnel waiting to get out of Ellen Road as fast as possible.
It is interesting that Beckford is the hero of the day, given that we were talking a few episodes back of him being booed and abused by the crowd, and that he was almost public enemy number one because he wasn't putting enough effort in, and he'd put in his transfer request and he was going to go and play for somebody else in the summer, whatever happened. And you listen to Beckford talking about Leeds United now, and he never brings it up. One day they go through this game, he's talking about the love he felt from the stands in this match, and the part that the crowd played in that day for Leeds made it so much easier to play for. And that he said that he was there's a beautiful moment on that when he says that he became a fan of the club, not just of the club he played for, but of the players he played with. He was, he was a Leeds United fan, even though he was in the team. And even though a big section of the crowd were being horrible to him. And he'd not had a comfortable time with Grayson. I don't think behind the scenes, the question of him being, subbed off, throwing tantrums, transfer requests, being dropped, being back in the team, I don't think that will have been easy for either of them. But that's football. And they talk about it as well. When there's the great stories on there of apparently Patrick Kisnorbo and Max Gradle, because they played together at Leicester. From the first moment they're together at Leeds, they were arguing every single day, to the thought that the point that Jermaine Beckford thought, do they actually genuinely hate each other? Is there a problem here? But it's just the way they interacted with each other every day on the training pitch. It seems like Kisnorbo probably just wound Gradle up by kicking him in training every day just to get a reaction, because it's fun. And these things happen during a football season. And then at the end of it, though, you are the hero. And the person you've been arguing with, who's been criticising you, telling you to do more, is the one who gave you the armband on the final day, and then is giving you the biggest hug you ever had in the final minute, and then wants to take you to every single club he ever manages ever again. Beckford gets cut off talking about it, because I think the goal happens, and I'm sure he said it elsewhere as well. He was hoping that by scoring this goal and getting Leeds into the Championship, there would be a new contract for him at Ellen Road, and that he was ready and waiting for Ken Bates to kind of come, all right, son, you weren't worth this in League One, but we can give you this in the Championship. What do you think about staying? And that was his real, just his last hope, that there was still a way for him to stay at Leeds. And obviously he was never going to get an offer anywhere close what Everton were about to give him. But I think it's worth remembering that it wasn't quite over for him there, and so it must have been mixed feelings of, can I stay, please?
Talk me through what you did at full-time.
Ran on the pitch, didn't I? Same with everyone else. Well, Ben Fry went, please get off. You're naughty, all of you. We told you. We said to get, not, it said on the screen for ages, don't go on the pitch, and I kept saying it, and now here you are, on the pitch. Well, please get off, would you?
I did enjoy on the watch back that none of the players could remember his name. The pitch announcer guy, was it Ben or somebody? I mean, he was
the little tubby child that used to do it. Strange looking kid.
He was absolutely integral to LUTV and the club media at the time, and they've all forgotten him. Yeah, I'm sure I was in the East Upper. I may be told I was it was the lower, but got onto the pitch and I decided I wanted to touch Robert Snodgrass, who had just come on as a late substitute, and I managed to achieve that. He was being hoisted aloft on people's shoulders nearby, so I ran over and I smacked him very firmly on the thigh. And I've never washed that hand since.
I think I was pretty late to the pitch. I think I more or less waited for everyone else to go on first because I was just stood watching it all unfold. And I don't know, I think just drinking in a little bit because I'd not seen anything like that before. I didn't go on the pitch when we'd been on the pitch against Charlton, hadn't we, when we got relegated from the Premier League. I seem to remember there was a pitch invasion that day and I didn't bother because it was just sad. Oh, and Ipswich, yes. that was a more limited pitch invasion and a bit less friendly. So I didn't go on that one either. I didn't go on that time either. But I don't know, I thought I'm going to stand and watch this for a bit. I'll go on the pitch when I'm ready. And then weirdly, when I got there, I bumped into Oddie, who obviously was involved in the podcast at the time and still is, and has always been involved with a mag, and picked his daughter up and like chucked her in the air a bit. And it's just such a lovely day.
I was sat in a passenger seat in a car getting driven back from the clay pigeon shooting back towards central Manchester at that point. And I can remember still, I could tell you exactly what the vista. I was looking at a factory and I had to look out of the window to the left and away from everybody else in the car because I started tearing up.
I definitely cried that day. And I think I even cried the next morning when I woke up. I'd been out that night and I'd stayed at my mate's. So I was sleeping on a bare floor in a like a tatty sleeping bag that I used to have in the boot of my car because I was a bit of a traveller in those days. I used to just pitch up places whenever after a night out. So just remember waking up on this floor in a sleeping bag and having like with the horrendous hangover as well and having like a little celebration and a cry to myself. You sort of just woke up and went, yes, we've done it. We've done it. We've still done it. It wasn't a dream.
This was the one. And I know some younger Leeds fans maybe look at the Champions League days and think, oh, you know, that would have been great to see Leeds at the pinnacle of European competition, cheering them on from the first qualifying rounds all the way to the semi-final. Great days against 1860 Munich and so on. But none of those matches. I remember vividly the Milan game and Boya's equaliser and what a great goal that was to celebrate.
You mean Boya's winner?
Boya's winner, even. I had the Barcelona game in my head for a moment, which even conceding against Barcelona had a kind of Rivaldo's late equaliser for them was kind of still a, you know, we're at the heights here. This is the big Leeds. It's cool. It's cool to be here. And I don't know what the away trips were like because I couldn't afford or go away on any of the away trips. But none of those games ever gave me what the Bristol Rovers game did. It eclipsed any other game I've attended as a Leeds fan. The first game I saw at Elland Road was Gordon Strachan lifting the first division title that we'd won the weekend before at Sheffield United. And that was fun, but that's a little bit, you know, you're just watching somebody lift a trophy and then it was a fairly bad game, enlivened by a brilliant Rod Wallace individual goal. But then this was the one. If you were there for this, if you weren't an idiot like Dan off at somebody's joke function, but you were too young for the Champions League, don't worry about it. This was better.
I agree. I think the thing with this was that it was the end. It was a completed thing. Winning Champions League games and whatnot and playoff semi-finals and stuff, like they're really good days at the time. But then there has to be something after them, which ruins it a bit. Whereas this was, it was the end of something. It was completed. It's Andy Hughes, when he talks about it, he says, you know, knowing we'd done that for Leeds United, and he completely acknowledges it's like the biggest club he's ever played for and what have you. But it was that feeling. It was like, that is done. People can't take this away from us now. The League One period is over. And I think from my point of view, this meant more to me as well, because it was the years, the League One years were the years I'd spent most of my time going away as well. Like, I'd been to an awful lot of these games home and away, and I'd invested a huge amount in this team. And I suppose how horrible it would have been to mess it up again. We had the flip of it, that it was so glorious and such a complete relief and a release to actually do it in this ridiculous way that we did.
And that's what we live for. This is what football's about. It's these moments, maybe once a decade, once every 20 years, where it's just pure, unadulterated joy. And I think with reference to what Andy Hughes did say there, let's leave the final word on this. Give us his exact words.
We've won something with the greatest club in the world, and no one can take that away from us.
We will return next time with a mug up for grabs in the mailbag. If you want to get involved with that, squareball.net/WhatsApp, or you can head to 07899555459. However, before we go and sign off from this episode, we need to do the quiz, aka Jemmy McMastermind, and so on and so forth. We had some objections at the start of this episode from you, Michael, because you were claiming erroneously that the 1860 Munich game in the quiz last week wasn't part of the Champions League. Well, I've got up now the UEFA competition regulations. So let me just read these words to you. The UEFA Champions League competition system, the competition stages are as follows. Qualifying phase, playoffs, UEFA Champions League comprised of blah, 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 blah. It's there. It's part of the competition stages. Therefore, it is by definition part of the Champions League. Your objections, while noted, are rejected and Moscow has the quiz.
I'm going to return with new evidence next week. I'm not going to let this rest.
Meanwhile, let's get on with an exciting game of Who Said This? So you're going to have to tell me the answers on over Slack, over our direct messaging system. So I hope you both got that ready. Bearing in mind that I asked five of these last time I was in charge of the quiz because I had won. What remains are the five that I thought might be too difficult or too obscure to play with. And bear in mind the score in that was zero each.
I hope you've got a decent tiebreaker.
I haven't got a tiebreaker. So
you idiot.
I will. Maybe we won't need it. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But so the game is Who Said This? And so the first one, I think, given a second chance, he'd have come in and been a bit more diplomatic. I think, given a second chance, he'd have come in and been a bit more diplomatic. Who said that?
Did you say, are these from a book?
Oh, of course, I've not given...
From 2004 or something. I vaguely remember you saying this before.
It's the Little Book of Leeds United, edited by Neil Jeffries, who is the current programme editor and a very fine fellow. He used to do Leeds magazine. First published by Carlton Books in 2002. ISBN 1-84222-7351.
Okay, probably don't need the full.
Okay, I have answers from both of you. So, number two, who said this? Lock that boy up in a cage and throw away the key until he's a Leeds player. Don't let any other club near him. Lock that boy up in a cage and throw away the key until he's a Leeds player. Don't let any other club near him. Who said that? I will offer bonus points, actually, if you can tell me who was being spoken about in both that one and the first question as well.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Answers from both. And the next one, number three. The kids came through from the swimming pool and said that Leeds had signed Finney Jones. I started laughing and they said no, it was serious. I leapt into the pool but thought, there's no point in drowning yourself. You're getting well paid. The kids came through from the swimming pool and said that Leeds had signed Finney Jones. I started laughing. They said no, it was serious. I leapt into the pool but thought, there's no point in drowning yourself. You're getting well paid. So you've both answered quickly there. Interesting. Question four. Who said this? The changing rooms are full of under 17-year-olds, tiny lads. In Leeds training gear, there's loads of them. The changing rooms are full of under 17-year-olds, tiny lads in Leeds training gear. There's loads of them. Who said that?
These aren't all Leeds people, are they? It's just randomers as well sometimes.
There are a few randomers involved, yes.
Ah.
Dan has answered the silent assassin has already, but then I hear an ah.
Well, all mine so far are Leeds, so that's kind of a bit of a curveball in terms.
So are mine, to be fair. It's just last year, wasn't Vic Reeves one of them last year?
Yeah, Vic Reeves was one. So there's the potential for you to need to think laterally, but not necessarily a requirement.
Don't know that one at all, complete guess.
Okay, right.
Not that I've got the others right, probably, but you know.
Last one could be crucial. The lifestyle is much the same. Bad clothing, bad food. So we don't expect too much. The lifestyle is much the same. Bad clothing, bad food. So we don't expect too much. Who said that?
When was this book published again?
2002. It was printed in Singapore.
So read that one again.
The lifestyle is much the same. Bad clothing, bad food. So we don't expect too much. There is a CIP catalogue record for this book available from the British Library. If you are interested. Right, got an answer from Michael.
I might change it.
Well, am I allowing you to change it?
Yeah, there's no...
You've got until Dan answers. Dan's answered.
I can't think of anyone else either, so never mind.
All right, let's go through. Right, back to the start. Who said, I think, given a second chance, he'd have come in and been a bit more diplomatic. Dan, who do you think?
I went for Don Revie about Brian Clough, but I suspect I've got the right subject matter, but maybe they're not the right person who said it.
And Michael?
Same reason. I went Eddie Gray, but it just sounded, it was a really nice thing to say, so that's why I thought it was Eddie Gray.
You both get a point for Brian Clough. You don't get a point because it was Trevor Cherry who said it.
Ah, another nice man. I was almost... Do I get a point for having a really nice man?
No.
No, okay.
Next one. Lock that boy up in a cage and throw away the key until he's a Leeds player. Don't let any other club near him. Who said that, Dan?
Wilkinson.
About?
A player.
Okay. Michael?
I went Don Revie about Alan Clark. I was considering Giles either.
It was Jack Charlton about Eddie Gray. Apparently after his first training session, and he rang rings around him. He wanted him locked up in a cage. Which shows youth training schemes have kind of changed quite a lot since the 1960s. The kids came through from the swimming pool. It's the third one, and said that Leeds had signed Vinnie Jones. I started laughing, and they said, no, it was serious. I leapt into the pool, but thought, there's no point in drowning yourself. You're getting well paid. Dan?
Well, I'm going for Gordon Strachan.
So am I.
But the swimming pool makes me wonder if it's maybe somebody who's retired, or but then you said paid, so it might be a current player. Strachan, yeah.
It was Gordon Strachan.
Yay!
Yes. So you're both on 2 points. So this is already going much, much better than last time. Number four. The changing rooms are full of under 17-year-olds, tiny lads in Leeds training gear. There's loads of them. Dan?
Edwin Gray.
Michael?
Wilco.
Stephen McPhail. I think that should have been obvious. Obvious to both of you.
It is a very famous quote, yeah.
And so fifth, this one's crucial because it's 2-2. The lifestyle is much the same. Bad clothing, bad food. So we don't expect too much. Dan?
My logic was somebody who's from a country that's got normally got reputation for good food and style. So I was thinking along the lines of France and Italy. Ran out of time. Panicked just to try and block Michael from changing his answer and put Cantona.
And Michael?
I put someone who was coming from Germany with the bad food and the bad clothing and went Tony Yeboah, but I don't think it sounds like him.
Who did you want to change it to?
I was trying to think, to be honest. I considered Hasselbank as well. It sounded more like something he would have said, but I don't know.
It was Alf Inger Haaland.
Ah.
So, going to have to think of a tiebreaker. Okay, we've been talking about the 2009-10 season for what feels like 100 years. So you should be very well versed in the minutiae of that season. Nothing should have escaped you. So if I ask you to type, send me a direct message with the attendance for Stockport County 2, Leeds United 4... on the 28th of December 2009, Christmas fixture.
Do you want do you want the number of tickets sold or the actual number through the gate? Because I've got both.
I'm going to, let me just check these tally up. Hold on. Right, I'm taking it off the Wikipedia page, which is not an invitation for you to quickly go to that Wikipedia page, but without getting into kind of Champions League group stage qualifiers territory.
My answer's in.
Okay, Dan.
Make Dan do it quickly so before he looks.
I want your answer as well. I mean, we know that your internet is painfully slow, so there's probably no point you even trying. Oh, now.
Do you need maths?
Well, Dan's first guess was did include the decimal point that suggested there was 9 and a bit people. You both guessed quite close. Dan's actual guess is 9,125.
Okay.
Michael's guess, 9,555. The actual attendance was, and I'm going to give you the numbers in reverse order.
God, they should always do this when they announce the attendance. Thank you for your magnificent support and for your magnificent support of this bewildering method of reaching out in attendance.
Well, I want to make the six people feel very important. So it was 6877. That's 6,86,786,7,786. Dan Moylan has won.
Shit.
Do you know, I was toying with the idea of 8,000, but it felt too low. I didn't realise it was such a small ground. That, mind you, they were absolutely desperate, weren't they, at that point?
I remember it being quite full. How was that? Didn't count everyone, did I? I knew I should have done at the time. I knew I'd forgotten something as I left that ground.
Well, yeah, Edgeley Park, I'm just looking on the Wikipedia, it does hold over 10,000 people, but yeah, not a full house that day.
That was a tax fiddle, because Stockport was struggling. They under-declared the attendance, and the chairman left with bags of cash in his car. Well, that's a fact.
If you can find documentary proof to satisfy the Stockport chairman's lawyers before the next episode, we might revisit this decision. But as it stands, it is my bitter, horrible duty to inform you that Dan has won.
Shit, I think I've won in about 4 weeks now. I was winning as well.
He'll be coming at us with more ill-informed nonsense next time.
Ill-informed, but absolutely correct nonsense. On which note, then, we will sign off for this one. Thank you for your company during this show. We'll speak to you next time. The Extra Ball.